Welcome to CyberFix, your dopamine-infused tech news update. My name is Gabriel, here to help get other information junkies up to speed with important tech news. Stay tuned for a lighthearted exploration of hostile cyberspace and what we can do about it. This is episode 6, being recorded on August 25th, 2024, and we'll be discussing tech disasters, leaks, hacks, and hyperreality. Then a solutions roundup, diving into tools, concepts, and pushback. After the break, control grid updates, the latest in technocracy. And then lastly, the finer details, nanobots, cryptocurrency, and more. So our first segment for this show is tech disasters. And oh boy, do I have a disaster for you. Leaping Computer is reporting hackers leak 2.7 billion data records with social security numbers. It's worth pointing out that this is not limited to the US. The personal data seems to come from the US, the UK, and Canada, which was stolen from a company called National Public Data. Despite the name making one think this is a public entity, no, this is a private entity that was aggregating information from various sources. This means there is one, but possibly other aggregators collecting seriously sensitive personal identity information. The only reason we know about this particular instance, however, is because somebody going by the name of US DOD leaked the information in its entirety on the dark web for free. Normally, what happens is that somebody who will steal this kind of treasure trove of data will try to get some money for it, whether it be from a ransom from the company they stole it from or to other hacking groups. My biggest concern is how is this information being used in general? For instance, we've seen governments across the world buy location data when in theory they're not supposed to. Is leaked data, is hacked data really off limits for these kinds of outfits? And this represents a serious problem. Many commentators have pointed out that the challenge with these kind of data breaches going on in the background is that if you have quote unquote dark web monitoring, as in you pay for a service to check the dark web for information for you, they're not buying up all these breaches. They can really only see the ones that are public. So ironically, if somebody had dark web monitoring and they were, let's be honest, quite likely to be included in this breach, then they would actually get the notification and believe, it's working as intended. And yes, in this particular instance, it helps, but that does not mean it is the full extent of breaches you're included in. For many big stories, I try to include multiple links to the story. Depending on where you go for a particular story, event, or whatever, you tend to get a slightly different focus. So in this story is no exception. I have linked to both Bleeping Computer and TroyHunt.com for different perspectives on this issue. Troy Hunt's post has quite a bit more detail, so if you're interested in that, you might want to dig in. As always, all the links are included in the notes. One of the things I'd like to highlight from Troy Hunt's website that he says here, the problem with verifying breaches sourced from data aggregators is that nobody willingly, knowingly provides their data to them. So I can't do my usual trick of just asking impacted subscribers if they've used National Public Data before. Usually, also, I can't just look at a data aggregator breach and find pointers that tie it back to the company in question due to references in the data mentioning their service. That's because the data is just so damn generic. Take the earlier screenshot with the social security number data. How many different places have your first name, last name, address, social security number, etc.? Attributing a source when there's only generic data to go by is extremely difficult. And I think this is an important thing to consider, that when one is just simply motivated in stealing data, it really doesn't matter to them to keep the entire database intact. There is a whole lot that can be done to basically erase the source of the information, and effectively, aggregators do that to each other all the time by aggregating data from other sources. People generally have the same grab bag of recommendations when personal information is leaked online. Sometimes people go as far as to recommend credit monitoring. Other people recommend at least making sure to check your bank statements for any bizarre activity. I think the sad truth of the matter is that there's actually very little that can be done about these incidents. And it's really important to consider what this means moving forward. For instance, many people are justifiably concerned about the shift governments are making towards digital identity systems. But if everybody's existing identity information is more or less in the public anyways, I'm not necessarily saying we're at that point yet, that represents a serious problem for everybody. One of the things I would like to highlight in the digital ID discussion is that authentication is not identification. One of the biggest things that digital identity schemes tend to do is, by making it more convenient for people, they blend these two things together. To authenticate with various services, whether it's government services or other linked services, you authenticate with them through your digital identity provider, and that is what combines the two. In theory, there is nothing necessitating that you authenticate with a digital identity provider. It's entirely possible, with secure cryptography and offline hardware-based solutions, that one could authenticate with a key that does not require any permission from an external system. Ideally, I would love to see more innovation in this category. I think a lot can be done to stave off authoritarian digital identity if we can actually build secure and robust bottom-up authentication methods, in which case many of these systems will be obsolete. Next up, we have Microsoft confirms August updates breaks Linux boot in dual boot systems. For those of you who aren't aware, you can run Linux alongside Windows. What you will do is you will basically subdivide your hard drive into the part that's already running Windows, and then another bit of extra space, or even using a different drive altogether, you can then install Linux on that separate part. You can simply turn your computer on, and then it'll allow you to choose between booting into Windows and Linux. Personally, as a usability standpoint, I actually don't necessarily recommend doing that for anything beyond learning, because I believe day to day, the complexity you are introducing just makes it harder on yourself. But on a laptop or something you take with you on the go, maybe it is a more convenient option. Quoting from the article, "The issue is caused by a Secure Boot Advanced Targeting SBAT update applied to block Linux bootloaders unpatched against CVE 2022-2601 Grub2 Secure Boot Bypass Vulnerability." Now that's quite a bit of a mouthful, but I just want to highlight to you that Secure Boot is a feature on your motherboard that basically decides whether code can run on your machine or not. In some ways, this is helpful. It prevents people from basically installing an OS on top of your system to control everything you're doing, in theory, but I mean, malware itself will always be a problem. Some people are pretty skeptical of Secure Boot security guarantees to begin with, but that's the idea behind it. You validate the systems running on the system to make sure they are at least signed by something, so that people are not installing unknown software on a particular device. Of course, this generally raises concerns about, well, how are people going to run independent operating systems? But this is just one of many options available. According to the article, the only verified way to revive any impacted system is to disable Secure Boot. Install the latest system of your Linux distribution and then re-enable Secure Boot. There is a way to opt out of the fix, so to speak, by adding a parameter to your registry. The next up post is zero-click Windows TCP IP RCE impacts all systems with IPv6 enabled patch now. So while the headline may sound like a bunch of gobbledygook gibberish, it's actually quite terrifying. When I saw that headline, I was like, damn, I'm glad I'm not on Windows anymore. But I'll explain step by step what it means. Zero click means that there is no interaction on the victim's part required to make it work. It is automatic. It just happens. That's generally what raises a lot of concerns, because people generally give advice like don't click emails, don't accept strange files, all that kind of stuff. But there are many vulnerabilities that do not require such interaction. And that's something I want to raise people's awareness of, is that we're talking about somebody wanting a perfectly secure system. There are many problems that can manifest themselves that are out of scope of your own behavior. The system itself matters a great deal. It's not just down to you. A whole lot has to be done to ensure the system is safe from these kinds of exploits. Next up, the thing is Windows TCP/IP. So TCP/IP is the low-level protocol that the internet runs on. So I'll just summarize that as it's a network problem. Network problems tend to be quite insidious as a whole, because low-level networking knowledge is not something that is very well understood by definitely computer users, but even various techies. You know, somebody who struggles with the concept of DNS is definitely going to have trouble with low-level TCP/IP details. The last acronym there is RCE, which is short for Remote Code Execution. What that means, if you chain all these things together, is there is a vulnerability that requires no interaction from Windows users that affects them over the network, but allows remote code execution. So this is effectively a backdoor. There's one, you know, one way. It's the most blatant example of a exploit that could be used as a backdoor, where you just simply connect to the device and you have remote access. So, of course, Microsoft has already fixed this. This is something that was reported on, you know, August 14th, so almost 2 weeks ago. But I really want to highlight it because it's a very important example of serious vulnerabilities that are out there in the wild. While this particular one is something somebody can be patched for, this particular vulnerability has been in the background for quite some time. Another thing the article points out is that it is a wormable vulnerability. If you impact one system, you can use it to impact other systems, jumping from system to system to create what's called a worm. A worm is terrifying because it can generally take over systems in a very quick period of time. And the advantage of having control over many different systems is then you can do all kinds of terrifying things like DDoS attacks, but more importantly, it allows somebody such as a state-level hacking group to evade detection if it's done behind all these different systems. That's why there's a great deal of monitoring on botnet traffic and various attempts to follow these kinds of systems. Quoting from the article, over the last 4 years, Microsoft has patched multiple other IPv6 issues, including two TCP/IP flaws tracked as CVE-2020-1689/9, also called Ping of Death, that can be exploited in remote code execution and denial of service attacks using malicious ICMPv6 router advertisement packets. Additionally, an IPv6 fragmentation bug left all Windows versions potentially vulnerable to a denial of service attack, and a DHCPv6 flaw made it possible to gain remote code execution with a specially crafted call. So ultimately, this is a huge problem for Microsoft and enterprises running serious amounts of Windows systems, running important systems. As a home user, I would imagine being up to date and ensuring you're not doing anything crazy, like allowing your computer to be directly accessible on the network unless you know what you're doing, is really the most anyone can do. I don't run Windows, but if I was still running Windows, I would probably be resetting it on a very regular basis. I think 6 months is a good cadence where like you're doing it often enough that over time it's regular, but at least it's not something you're doing every day or every week. Another reason I recommend reinstalling your system every once in a while is that it gets you into the habit of having a good backup system. If you were able to erase your system, start from scratch, and put everything back on with whatever backup system you have set up, that is a very good practice run for if anything serious does happen to your system. Next up is Google fixes ninth Chrome zero day tagged as exploited this year. So quoting from the article, Google is aware that an exploit for CVE-2024-7971 exists in the wild, company said in an advisory published Wednesday. This high severity zero day vulnerability is caused by a type confusion weakness in Chrome's V8 JavaScript engine. Security researchers with the Microsoft Threat Intelligence Center and Microsoft Security Response Center reported it on Monday. Though such security flaws can commonly enable attackers to trigger browser crashes after data allocated into memory is interpreted as a different type, they can also exploit them for arbitrary code execution on targeted devices running unpatched browsers. This is just another example of why being up to date is very important, because these kind of vulnerabilities are something that the bad guys will just kind of keep track of. They'll keep a list of these kinds of vulnerabilities and just try them out. That's why it's generally said that if somebody really wants to get at you, there's not a whole lot you can do to prevent it, because there will always be some vulnerability floating around that can get you. Browser vulnerabilities are especially heinous because many people take for granted that their browsers are safe. Oh, as long as I don't click a suspicious link or I don't, you know, go to seedy websites, I must be fine. But there are many challenges that make that calculus a little bit more different. I would honestly say what you define as a safe website should be a lot more narrow than one would think. Of course, the best way to deal with this is ultimately to lock down your browser, don't allow scripts to run, you know, be very selective about what sites you visit, those kinds of things. That's why I'm interested in the many projects that can hopefully improve the browser landscape, because it is clear that both Firefox and Chrome are probably too big and bloated to be properly secured based off how we understand the situation as it exists today. Last up in tech disasters, I want to dip into hyperreality a little bit. Chris Welch on Threads has a fascinating thread about the new AI features in the Pixel 9 device. It appears as though the camera app for the Pixel 9 allows you to basically deepfake or use AI to insert elements into photographs you've taken that look photorealistic into those photos. There are many examples in the thread. You might want to take a look at them in the link in the description. But the first example is he introduces a broken bike and what appears to be a car accident in a photo where there was none. While you could probably zoom in and nitpick the particular parts in this broken car bike crash and evaluate whether you think this is a realistic copy, the next example is a photo of his daughter sitting on a couch and a adorable little dog is edited in next to her stuffed dog, and it actually looks pretty lifelike. I would certainly not be suspicious at all if I looked at that photo. And then there is another example where people were staring at what looks like a fallen rooftop, and he edits various different photos on top of the rooftop, such as a pancake, a dead pig, or a just giant slab of steak. And these are actually quite convincing images. Of course, the pancake is cartoonishly large, so you wouldn't really think that's a real photo, but visually, it certainly looks like it fits. One of the examples I found very interesting, there's two of them here, is where he has a photo of somebody on a subway station and he asks the AI to draw a flood in the subway station. And again, I will say it's quite a convincing photo, as well as with a waterfall leaving the train, that's a little less convincing. The water is pretty much all the same color. It's not clear whether this is water or just some viscous white fluid. Who knows what that is? So there are many examples examples here, but people are kind of using this instance to say, oh my God, we can't trust photo evidence anymore. It's time to freak out about how we're going to attribute various AI images. And the truth is, we've had the ability to create manipulated photos for a long time. Hollywood is a perfect example of creating, you know, fancy videos that may or may not actually be real, so to speak. And so it's important to step back and realize that the ability to fool people is not new. What is new is that it is now so accessible. Now, suddenly your friend can send you a photo of a teddy bear driving a UPS truck, and they can say, haha, look at this. And maybe in an emotional context, that can be really terrifying. Maybe they can send you a photo that looks like there was a break-in at their house and they want you to run over and come over, and you get there and they're like, haha, I was just kidding and stuff like that. Like, I'm sure pranks are going to be a lot worse when it comes to these kind of tools, but I do not expect this to be this kind of world-ending phenomenon that many people kind of hype this up to be. Of course, when it comes to anyone sending you a photograph and making extraordinary claims, it's important to pause and think about it, assess how likely the situation is, maybe even ask for more details, and really just take it from there. I would not recommend terrifying friends and family over this. Maybe it is a good idea to keep the pranks in good taste, but by all means, this is something that's going to become more and more embedded into our lives as these tools become more and more accessible. Moving on to Solutions Roundup, diving into tools, concepts, and pushback. First up in our Solutions Roundup, we have Lunduke's Locals post talking about total Linux desktop PCs now over 56 million. I would say a round of applause to all those who are running desktop Linux. While running desktop Linux is no panacea to all your security issues, in my opinion, the greatest advantage of switching to Linux is having so much free and open source software at your fingertips to really reclaim your own digital autonomy. Anything you can do to adopt more offline workflows and use systems that empower you rather than empowering tech giants and multinational corporations goes a long way towards building a better digital future. So while it's certainly not a doubling, it is clear by these stats that Linux desktop users across the world are significantly increasing. According to Statista, December 2022, there was 33,855,000. And now, as of July 2024, it is 56,379,000. But I really want to point out here that the challenge with many of these systems is that by definition, the more you enhance your privacy, the harder it is for you to be represented by systems that rely on these stats. It's certainly not impossible. If somebody uses a website and collects user agents, they would certainly know what percentage of their visitors use Linux, but that will never account for the fact that maybe their website is less visited by Linux users overall. I call this the feedback trap, where when you're trying to be private or trying to respect the privacy of others, you inevitably give up a lot of information that is used by people to make important business decisions. It's unclear to me what the ideal solution to the feedback trap is, because I'm not in favor of surveillance. I'm not going to say, oh, we should accept a certain level of surveillance to get a little bit of feedback beyond reusing information that's already there. For instance, if somebody visits your website, you're going to know that a entity has visited your website. I don't think there's anything inherently wrong with recording, hey, I got a visit at this time, at this date. The IP kind of seems like it's in this country, you know, high level information like that. That's reasonable. The challenge is as this gets more invasive, the more information you collect on your users, the more of a threat you are to their privacy. This is a big reason why I also make an effort to run hidden services on my website. So if one wants to opt out of any tracking systems whatsoever, they can certainly visit my website on either the Tor browser or through I2P. So please pardon the mini rant about the feedback trap. I think this is an important concept moving forward as more people try to reclaim their digital autonomy. This does mean we're not going to get these rallying cries of, wow, look at how many people are doing it. It's like you're not going to know. It's something that is going to be very quiet. It's going to be in the background. And try to just measure success in terms of what you and people you know are able to do, and maybe not necessarily try to worry about everybody doing the right thing. That's certainly a little too high a bar for really everything out there. Moving on to the next item in this Solutions Roundup. I came across this tool, LogSec. For those who don't know, this is a writing application to manage your own notes. Most famously, most people might be familiar for using Obsidian, which manages your notes and has pretty graphs and a whole lot of advanced features. I am excited to announce that it looks like LogSec is an actual competitor to Obsidian that is free and open source. So I am absolutely giddy to try it out. I might actually migrate my own personal note system, and honestly, I've kind of fallen behind on personal journaling across the board, but I am excited for this particular project and I will be using it more moving forward. Another tool I've come across, and I think it's quite fascinating, is surveillancewatch.io. If you go to their website, they'll say they know who you are. It's time to uncover who they are. Surveillance Watch is an interactive map revealing intricate connections between surveillance companies, their funding sources, and affiliations. This tool really is beautiful, and the first thing that came to mind when I saw this is it would be very interesting if somebody was able to turn this way of presenting information into a library so that more projects could really use this form of global visualization for other pieces of information. While I think privacy is important, and I think this topic is worth understanding, there are many other circumstances where you would want a interconnected global demonstration of particular activities. For instance, you could make a censorship map that follows this very similar example. Surveillancewatch.io has three different ways of browsing the entities in their database. You can first look at the surveilling entities, such as the companies doing the data collection and surveillance. You can also browse by targets. For instance, I am in Canada. It will list the entities like OneByte, ASIC Networks, Balkasoft, Black Cube, Briefcam, Citadel, Clearview AI, Finfisher, Gamma Group, MFI Soft, NSO Group, Q Cyber Technologies SARL, RoboTeam, Zenstar Technologies Corp, Vulpin Security. Of course, there will be many listings for any other countries or regions you select. For instance, there are 66 entities under the United States. I'm sure that's probably just a small fraction of the overall list, though you can actually submit information to them, as well as on top of the surveilling and the targets, they also list funding organizations. So for instance, if you open up BlackRock Inc., it will list that they are funding BAE Systems, L3 Harris, and Palantir. Again, just to reiterate, this is a very interesting way of getting a surface level view of mass surveillance worldwide, as well as just really an excellent example of how to represent this kind of information. This is an elegant tool that I hope more people become familiar with. Next up, going in a completely different direction, I have a paper here on Cornell University, HyperSyn, a peer-to-peer system for mutual credit. One of the things that has been frustrating me lately is that many people are talking as if blockchain, cryptocurrencies, and CBDCs are the only options. You must either allow your government to have total control over the financial system, or you must accept some form of a new network state blockchain project to become the new state. Personally, I reject both of those options out of hand. I do not believe cryptocurrencies as they currently exist really are up to the task of challenging digital tyranny. There is a whole lot that needs to be learned technologically, financially, and really just as far as infrastructure is concerned before we can seriously consider building an independent digital currency. One of the more novel approaches is to figure out how to do a system of mutual credit. Mutual credit is actually not a new concept. It's something that's been well understood prior to digital systems, but I think it's an important concept to consider when thinking about how you build what James Corbett would call a survival currency. For instance, the purpose of your independent currency should not necessarily be this brand new get-rich-quick scheme, but should rather be how can you build the infrastructure to build something that can actually help people in your community thrive and resist the digital tyranny that is going on. This requires vastly different approaches that have been attempted in the blockchain space and definitely the CBDC space. And so I think it's an important concept to really think about when it comes to building decentralized systems. I'm not saying that mutual credit is the only way of solving this problem, but I do think that mutual credit is a fantastic starting point for being inspired on how you would actually architect a survival currency in the digital age. Last up, RFK Jr. and Children's Health Defense get green light to sue Biden administration for censorship. This is because many other cases in regards to state censorship, particularly on Twitter, but also on other platforms, have generally failed due to lack of standing. Personally, as somebody who is not that well versed in legal matters, I don't quite understand the issue of standing very well. On some level, I would think it is intuitive that if you live in a country, you should be allowed to sue your government if they are doing something wrong. Because as a citizen, you automatically have stake as a taxpayer in what the government is up to. But the challenge here, reading from the article, standing is the legal doctrine that requires plaintiffs to show they have suffered direct and concrete injuries and that those injuries could be resolved in court in order to sue. And so I think this is the root of the problem, because when you have a government that is transgressing, you kind of need, I guess, a class action where you get everybody affected, which is difficult because not everybody's going to be able to do that, or you have somebody who understands the issue trying to build a case, but then they may not have standing. And it's very hard when the government, say, doing something to everybody in an opaque way. Is it really easy to prove that you specifically were harmed by that? For instance, if the government, I don't know, undermines everybody's security by banning encryption, are you personally, you know, entitled to damages from results from that? They'll be like, well, no, you have to go after the person who hurt you. So personally, as somebody who thinks we need more government accountability, I would love to be educated by somebody more knowledgeable than me at what the proper route for these kinds of things are, because it is clear that simply bringing the government to court for transgressions is not the ideal way to solve problems. I guess the counterpoint is that you should contact your representatives, but very often the representatives can point to, say, another court decision. Our governments are complicated, and I think there is no one single bullet for accountability. I just think it's an important thing to consider moving forward. We are therefore lucky in the sense that Children's Health Defense and RFK Jr. are able to proceed with this case, because I believe two things are important. One, free speech needs to be protected because it is likely one of the few things actually keeping any form of dissent alive these days, as power, control, and even economics becomes terrifyingly consolidated. But the other thing is that I do strongly believe it has to exist as a shared value or not at all. The problem is shared values can't thrive in environments where they are suppressed from the top down. Even if everybody believes that censorship is wrong and that free speech is important, if you have a system that allows more and more censorship, eventually you're going to have people who grew up in a world where they never knew free speech in the first place. They never quite got to see somebody speaking out and actually being able to challenge power in their lifetime with their words, with their work, whatever it is. And so those people will not be able to appreciate the importance of those principles. And so that is why I really emphasize that even outside of the legal matters, free speech is important for reasons beyond just the legal importance, but also real social and cultural ramifications. We should be pushing the legal system to recognize and uphold free speech values to protect our participation in civic matters, for transparency, and for accountability. Quoting directly from the defender, the Fifth Circuit sent the case back to the district court to rule on standing. In its ruling yesterday, Doty wrote, "This court finds that there is significant evidence showing Kennedy was directly censored in the past and that there is likely a substantial risk that Kennedy's content will be restricted in the future because of actions of at least one of the government defendants. It is undisputed that Children's Health Defense has satisfied the burden of showing injury in fact, for much of the same reasons that Kennedy has. Only one plaintiff needs to have standing for a case to move forward. The case will now proceed to the Fifth Circuit, which will rule on the preliminary injunction." As a Canadian, despite not having too much of a stake in this particular case, I am incredibly optimistic about what this means for the future of free speech online, because the United States really is at the forefront. For all Americans out there, I would highly encourage you to do what you can in your own life to protect freedom of speech as a widely shared value, and whatever can be done to uphold it legally. I'd like to know if anybody out there is listening. While I get analytics on PeerTube, I estimate the majority of my listeners are doing so through ways that give less feedback, such as the RSS feed. While there are ways I can tell if you start listening, I have no idea if people just tune out a few minutes or even seconds in. If you're somebody listening this far into the broadcast, I would love to hear from you. Your feedback is important to this project. Please consider leaving a like, comment, or just email me at gabriel@liberasolutions.network to let me know you heard this message. It would really mean the world to me to know how effective this particular broadcast is. The future of CyberFix depends on it. Thank you for listening to this free preview of CyberFix. Please share and consider becoming a supporter to gain access to the entire broadcast. There are two ways to gain access to the entire show. One, the easiest method is to go to gabe.rocks/substack and purchase a paid subscription. Two, for the cyber rebels among you, go to gabe.rocks/monero and sign up for a subscription over the Fediverse. Links will be available in the description.